May it please the court. My name is Amy Lowe, and I am here on behalf of Todd Bearden. We are here today to discuss the often condemned practice of group guilty pleas. In St. Francis County, my client, Mr. Bearden, pleaded guilty to two counts of possession of precursor chemicals with the intent to create methamphetamine. He pleaded guilty in a lineup plea in front of the Honorable Kenneth Wayne Pratt. Multiple defendants were taken in front of the court on completely unrelated charges. All of them had the plea inquiry done together. Nominally, this was to save time. The Eastern District Court of Appeals was correct in ruling that this procedure neither saved time nor met the basic merits of due process. A group plea procedure, a procedure used by only 9 of the 50 states, as far as I've been able to ascertain, and condemned even in those 9 by at least 6, should not have been used, does not save time, and merely redistributes time and effort to the appellate courts and later end of the criminal justice process, such as post-conviction relief. Further, it is an inherently ambiguous and frankly dehumanizing way to take a guilty plea that will attach multiple collateral consequences, as well as for many people, the actual loss of liberty by going to prison. This should not and cannot be allowed to stand.
There are different types of group pleas, aren't there?
Yes, Your Honor. And we're here today solely for those involving unrelated defendants, not co-defendants.
And sometimes when they are unrelated defendants, the state has multiple persons there and advises them of their rights jointly, but then examines them individually.
That is one option for how to do them, Your Honor.
And that's not what happened here.
In this case, we had group examination on nearly all questions, to the point that we can't even tell who answered some questions because the court reporter just has them listed identically in columns. They note that Mr. Bearden answers fourth, but not how they're numbered. So a review of the record can't even tell who gave what answer for several spots.
So was there ever a one-on-one part of the hearing that focused solely on his case?
There is some limited one-on-one inquiry as the court goes down the line, especially for if any statement was made to the police. I believe that they asked Mr. Bearden, as well as a fellow, I believe his name was Mr. Ellis, specifically as to if they had made statements while in or out of custody.
Is this done in a group basis, just while everybody's standing there, or was each person taken aside and privately?
Just fired? Down the line, Your Honor. So if this bench was, in fact, the line of defendants, I would ask Your Honorable Judge.
So if we were 7 defendants, right?
Yes. And then I would move on to Judge Powell and then on to Judge Wilson. There was no pulling aside, no private inquiry.
If counsel had objected and the trial court had said, okay, I'll take you last and we'll do you by yourself, what is there to suggest that he wouldn't have gone ahead and pleaded guilty and the court would have accepted it as it did in the group context?
The record doesn't show anything specific that undermines this plea. I am not going to tell the court that there is some imaginary line where my client would immediately have backed away, but we also need to look at the process here. And if the process itself is so against the weight of due process.
But the claim isn't that the process violates due process.
Yes.
The claim is ineffective assistance of counsel, which ordinarily requires prejudice.
And I do believe in this case what we would be looking at is the potential for pure confusion. We don't have anything in the record because the record is a mess. Because the record is unclear, and the reason the record is a mess, and the reason the record is unclear, is using this particular proceeding. Had the court done an individual inquiry, we would know things like what my client answered regarding the effective assistance of his counsel, what answer he gave, who was where in line. We would know the answers, we would have a clear idea, and we would also know that the presence of 5 other men on each side of my client didn't influence him to go through. I think there is an inherent pressure where someone is lined up with other individuals in custody who need this to go through in several cases if they are going to not be in custody at the end of the day. I don't think that there is any potential argument that that isn't a coercive force.
You know, my undergraduate degree was in psychology, so I would agree with you that a group does have an influence on an individual. But the problem we have in this case is on page 7, respondent's brief. It demonstrates that defendant was addressed specifically by the judge here. So even if I don't condone group pleas, he was specifically addressed and answered. I'm not going to read it, but on page 7, he answered specific questions that were asked to him.
Yes, Your Honor. He does answer limited specific questions. However, when we look through the entire plea colloquy, there are even more questions that are directed solely at the group. And these questions go to rights that aren't just incidental. This isn't just, how are you doing today? Are you all right with a group plea? This is, are you satisfied with your attorney? Do you really want to plead guilty? The individual questioning on some subjects doesn't cure the group questioning on all of the rest of these subjects.
But Mr. Bearden doesn't say, I didn't want to plead. I was coerced into pleading by the context of the group plea. I mean, he doesn't allege that he was confused. He doesn't allege that the factual basis was improper or insufficient. I mean, it's just a complaint about the process with nothing to tie it to him or his specific facts.
Mr. Bearden does complain of the factual basis, Your Honor. In the amended motion, we are looking at the sufficiency for the precursor chemical claims, especially involving the use of lithium under the current statute.
But was that tied to the claim about ineffective assistance for not objecting to the group plea?
I believe it is mentioned in the context of the factual basis claim. I would have to review my amended motion.
Yeah.
I apologize for not knowing.
I mean, I didn't mean to suggest he hadn't made the claim, but that claim wasn't the basis for the group plea insufficient ineffective assistance.
How are you saying the group plea affected the ability to determine the factual basis for the claim?
I think where we're looking at a group plea, and especially at a plea which begins, we're going to save some time here. We are going to do this as quickly as possible, all of you, up front. That indicates a fundamental failure in making an inquiry into the factual basis, in making sure that we meet the statute. And then we have a situation like Mr. Bearden's. You have a chemical that is used in methamphetamine manufacture, but it doesn't meet any of the actual definitions in the precursor chemical statute. The precursor chemical statute requires that it meet a very narrow range of areas. It has to be compounded, prepared on a list.
Well, then is your complaint that there's no, with the group plea, or is there no factual basis for the plea? Because it's not, you still haven't clarified how those two merge.
There are two separate claims in the amended motion, Your Honor. However, I do believe the group plea is by far the most important to this court, as it was the basis for transfer from the Eastern District, as well as, I think, the biggest flaw in accepting.
Judge Wilson's question was, assume for the moment we were to agree with you that a group plea asking about, in this context, after the preliminary questions, was improper. Is that sort of so what? Because we don't just say, gosh, this is good or bad. It has to tie into the facts of the case. And unless you allege prejudice from the fact that it was a group plea, and have you said the failure to establish the proper factual predicate was the result of the group plea, or was the result of counsel's incompetence and not knowing what the precursor chemicals are?
I think both errors feed into each other, Your Honor. You have counsel that doesn't sufficiently understand chemistry, and then you have a court that doesn't make a sufficient inquiry. That's one of the problems with the group guilty plea. It stops that fundamental function of the court being able to head off error. That's why we have individual questioning. So if I, as an attorney, advise someone to plead guilty, and they go in front of the neutral magistrate, and that magistrate goes, whoa, hold on a minute here, regardless of what your lawyer said, there's a problem, we can stop that error. We can avoid standing here.
So your complaint is the insufficient factual predicate, which didn't come out, and one of the reasons it didn't come out was because of the group plea.
Yes, as well as the additional prejudice that this is an inherently coercive manner of taking a guilty plea. That this is not a method of taking a guilty plea that could ever assure a voluntary guilty plea, which is one of our fundamental prongs for if we have established a valid guilty plea.
Well, the court's had several opportunities to agree with that argument and never has.
I believe, Your Honor, each time that this court has addressed it and condemned it,
I would say it's a bad idea.
Yes, you have said it is an extraordinarily bad idea. And obviously, that has not stopped the practice, as we are back yet again. We are back yet again with the practice that this court condemned in Roberts, admittedly not by saying it's unconstitutional, but by at least strongly stating against it. You again discouraged it in DePriest. And we are
still... DePriest specifically made this same allegation, though, correct?
Yes. In the end, though, this court ruled upon the conflict of interest claim. And I believe that the ruling on the matter of the group plea was, once again, a suggestion that this is disfavored. But the fundamental holding in the case
was what it in fact said was what you're arguing here was that was one of the causes of not discovering the conflict of interest because it was done as part of a group plea and there was no individual inquiry that would have revealed the conflict of two people represented by the same counsel.
Yes, and once again, we are back because this procedure leads to a record where things slip through the cracks.
Counsel, you're almost out of time. I want to have you addressed the state's argument that this amended motion was untimely filed and that the case should be remanded to determine whether or not movement was abandoned. You address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Under Rule 2907, the court is not required to make any inquiry into the effective assistance of counsel or the rights of defendants until final sentencing. When we look at the combination of Rule 2907, Rule 24035, and this court's holdings in cases such as Hall, which require us to prove delivery in a PCR, and Jackson, which requires that we show whether our claims are refuted by the record by that inquiry into the effective assistance of counsel, this mandates that as part of sentence, we have the transcript of the execution. Otherwise, I can't prove delivery on this case. I can prove that my fellow's in prison. But I believe all of us have encountered a situation where a defendant has been sent to prison on one case and remains on probation in another. This often leads us to a later writ case, which we have all seen in front of this court as well. The burden of proof and the interaction of these two rules indicate that sentencing itself is not final sentencing, or there would be no need for that adjective, and that final sentencing is necessary for the adjudication of a 24035 claim. And I see that I have run over my time, Your Honor. I can begin again upon rebuttal.
May it please the Court, briefly on the last issue that was addressed. The issue in the case is whether the deadline was triggered by the filing of a complete transcript of the guilty plea and sentencing as required under the rule. If the court were to construe the execution of sentence that occurred at the probation revocation hearing as part of sentencing, then the filing of that transcript on December 29th of the year preceding the filing of the amended motion would render the amended motion timely, in which case the state has no argument with proceeding on the merits. The state only raised that point in light of this court's decision in Moore, where the court sua sponte raised the issue of the timeliness of the amended motion. Before that point, the state and many other practitioners had assumed that in cases where it was merely a late filing, a remand would be pointless because the ordinary remedy would simply be to permit the untimely motion to be adjudicated. And so in many instances, it was viewed as a useless remand. But Moore made plain that it's not a useless remand because there will be circumstances, even if rare, where the movement is at fault, and the movement will then be required to proceed on the pro se motion instead of the amended motion. And so I raise the issue solely because of the court's observation in Moore that this is an issue that should be adjudicated and resolved by the motion court.
And the rule says, and I don't have it in front of me, but the time starts after the transcript of the sentencing of the trial and sentencing hearing, and should that include where sentence is imposed because the probationer is revoked?
In my experience, it has not in the past. I've had many instances where claims have been raised that counsel was ineffective at sentencing, and the error is alleged to have occurred at the probation revocation hearing where sentence was executed but not imposed. And the state's response and the court's response to such claims has been to say that that is not part of sentencing and that counsel cannot be ineffective there because sentencing has been completed at the time sentence was imposed. Now, it's a different situation when you have a suspended imposition of sentence because, of course, sentence hasn't been imposed until probation has been revoked, sentence has been imposed and executed. For purposes of the rule, I mean, the language says, quote, a complete transcript consisting of the guilty plea and sentencing hearing. If the court were so inclined, it could certainly construe the execution of sentence as part of sentencing hearing, to bring this case within the ambit of the rule and thus render the amended motion timely. In the ordinary case, the state's position has been that a probation revocation hearing is not part of sentencing, and so this would fall outside of that.
But would you agree with counsel, though, that the revocation hearing transcript would be relevant to their review of the pending issue?
Certainly, Your Honor. In some cases, a record that's made at that time could be relevant to issues that would be raised in a post-conviction proceeding. It might also cast light on, for instance, the date of delivery. However, all of those items, I think, are items that could be investigated, discovered, the delivery date. Something can be investigated and proved without any reference to a transcript, because a transcript, while advising us about execution, doesn't tell us how long the defendant might have remained, for instance, in the county jail before being actually delivered.
And the question isn't whether you can use the transcript from the revocation hearing.
Right.
The question is whether that's what triggers the deadline, or does it trigger when the filing is
correct,
made
Your Honor.
The sentence.
That's right. And during the time needed to draft an amended motion, any relevant transcripts from the probation revocation hearing could be obtained. They were in this case.
Isn't it the intention, though, of the rule to give the full period of time to consider the transcript during the period of time you have to file your motion?
I believe that was the intention of the rule, was to make sure that the complete record was available for counsel who's preparing an amended motion. And so would perhaps be a reasonable construction of the rule for this court to say that the execution of sentence that occurs at probation revocation hearing would be included in that rule. Again, I raised this issue merely because I felt compelled to do so by the court's holding in Moore.
But you want clarification. So
I would like a clarification would be good, and often that's what I'm seeking in these instances. Mm-hmm. And thus raise these issues. My personal preference would be to see the court address the merits of the claims in this case. At this point, I'll move to the merits. The process by which a guilty plea is obtained is not something that has to be done the same way every time, all the time. And the court has never held that a group guilty plea violates due process. In fact, to the contrary, the court has said that it doesn't, per se, violate due process and has rejected similar claims in the past. Now, that being said, the court has criticized, and I think that the word condemn overstates what the courts have said, but certainly the practice has been criticized because it carries with it risks. There are risks that can arise in these circumstances, and so the court has suggested or indicated that best practice may be to put this into our judicial history and move beyond this practice. But having said that, the court has also said, and in the Flood case, which I cite in my brief, which I believe was decided in 1972, the issue, and I'm paraphrasing, is not the procedure that's employed, but whether the defendant's plea is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Because that's what the Constitution requires in all cases, is that the defendant's plea be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. The United States Supreme Court set that standard in Boykin versus Alabama back in 1968, if I'm not mistaken about the date, and that's been the standard that has governed us ever since that time. It's reflected by other procedures in this state. Rule 2402, for instance, has procedures that trial courts are supposed to follow that are intended to protect that constitutional guarantee that it be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. All of the things that are required under Rule 2402 and that are required to obtain a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea can be obtained during a group guilty plea. Are there potential risks? Certainly. But of course, we have procedures that can come into play if those risks come to fruition. And that's why we have the post-conviction rule. And in this case, the defendant alleged that that the group guilty plea allowed a, quote, suspect factual basis to be laid, and also prevented him from addressing some alleged confusion that arose in his case, and namely confusion over the terms of the plea agreement. Well, the motion court took a look at those allegations and said, that's directly refuted by the record. And if you look at the record, which I'm sure you've done already, the group guilty plea indicates that there were certainly a number of questions where the defendants were questioned as a group, and they all answered down the line, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, Your Honor, yes, and in that regard. But there are several times throughout the plea proceeding where the court stopped and individually addressed each defendant. In particular, I would point out that when it came to the factual basis, the court individually questioned each defendant by name and addressed them and asked them, what did you do? Tell me what you did. So, you know, the factual basis was part of an individual inquiry. When it came to
In talking about an individual inquiry, though, you're still talking assembly
yes.
line. You're
yes.
not talking that as a group they were advised of rights and there were some preliminary matters, and then there was a separate guilty plea taken for individuals. Is this circumstance made even worse by the fact that there's one public defender who's representing six defendants?
Well, I'm not sure that it's worse per se. It's potentially worse if the public defender doesn't know anything about one of the cases, for instance. But I would expect somebody who didn't receive effective assistance or proper representation in such a proceeding to allege those facts and ultimately prove it. Now, there's been no allegation here, except for with regard to the factual basis, and I'll get to that in a moment, that the mere fact that counsel was dealing with multiple cases made it impossible for counsel to do the job. Now, to clarify one other thing about your question, when I say the defendant was individually questioned, I do not mean that the court, you know, broke them out and did that. They were still, as far as I can tell, lined up in front of the judge. But the judge, rather than asking a general question, addressed them by name and said, okay, now let's talk about your case, Mr. Bearden, or let's talk about your plea agreement. Let's talk about Mr. Bearden's plea agreement. And that's another area where the record shows that the court was individual in questioning the defendants, was about the plea agreement. And it's outlined in my brief where the court said, all right, prosecutor, what's the plea agreement for Mr. Bearden? And the prosecutor said, it's 7 years on count one, it's 7 years on count two. Those will be consecutive for a total of 14 years. This is plain language. The court turns to defense counsel and says, is that correct? Defense counsel confirmed that those were the terms of the plea agreement. The court then asked Mr. Bearden, is that what you understand the plea agreement to be? Yes, Your Honor. He may not have said yes, Your Honor. I think he said, I do understand. The court then asked him again another question. Well, do you have any questions about that? No, Your Honor. Again, I'm not sure he said no, Your Honor, but he said, no, I don't have any questions. He indicated he did not. And those were responses that the motion court looked to and found that the claim was refuted by the record that he had any confusion about the terms of the plea agreement. Now, the motion, the amended motion, was not any more specific about that. It just alleged confusion about the plea agreement. But the terms of the plea agreement were straightforward, plain on their face. He was asked about them specifically. He said he had no questions. And there was not a single allegation in the amended motion suggesting that either of his responses to the trial court's questions were false, confused, or wrong.
Can you address the factual predicate for the plea issue?
Sure. There are two claims related to that. One goes to the methamphetamine count. One goes to the possession of lithium. Excuse me. One goes to both counts, which was the intent to manufacture methamphetamine and what type of methamphetamine it was. And one goes only to the count dealing with lithium and not the count dealing with the possession of ephedrine. So as to the methamphetamine, the allegation is that the state failed to lay a or excuse me, that there was no factual basis for the idea that he intended to manufacture D-methamphetamine as opposed to L-methamphetamine, that these are two isomers of methamphetamine, and that only D-methamphetamine has the, quote, strong effect on the central nervous system that's required under the statute. Well, there are a couple of problems with this allegation. First of all, the statute makes no differentiation between these two isomers. In fact, it says all isomers of methamphetamine will satisfy our controlled substances under the schedule. And L-methamphetamine and D-methamphetamine, based on the allegations in the amended motion, and partly my curiosity looking them up, are simply mirror images, isomers. You know, if you look at the definition of an isomer, it's just, the molecular formula. And so you can have the same molecular formula but appear in different chemical structures. right? So the chemicals are attached to each other differently, but ultimately the same molecular formula. And they're mirror images of themselves. One is D, one is L, and according to the allegations in the amended motion, one is stronger. But the schedule does not specify that it must have a strong effect on the central nervous system. It just says it has an effect on the central nervous system. And there's no allegation in the amended motion that L-methamphetamine has zero effect. So even if you take all the allegations in the amended motion as true, both of these are isomers of methamphetamine. The statute identifies all isomers of methamphetamine as a controlled substance, scheduled substance. So whether he was intending to manufacture L or D, he's guilty. So this really didn't have to be part of the factual basis. In addition, the fact that it has an effect on the central nervous system isn't an element of the offense. That's a legislative determination. If you look at we don't have a Missouri case that says this, but I cited a case in my brief, State versus Ali out of Minnesota, which talks about similar language and says, you know, when the legislature put that in the schedule, that was just its legislative determination that the items following that on the list are the types of items that fit on this schedule because they have that effect on the central nervous system. So this isn't something that had to be part of the factual basis. It just had to be methamphetamine. And quite frankly, by inference, if he's making methamphetamine, he's probably doing it because he wants the effect on the central nervous system, not because he wants to produce something that could be used in over-the-counter drugs. The other claim is that the factual basis was lacking as to the lithium as a precursor. We have case law which holds that it is a precursor. The allegation is that an expert would have come in and said that lithium is not used in any of the manners outlined in the statute because it's used in a different manner. That's the sole allegation. I don't know what that means factually. And if you look at statutory language, it has to be a reagent, solvent, or any other chemical proven to be a precursor with the intent to manufacture, compound, convert, produce, process, prepare, test, or otherwise alter that chemical to create the controlled substance. And the court asked him specifically what he was going to do. It was alleged that he possessed these lithium batteries with the intent to alter them. And the court asked him, so are you going to use that chemical with others to create methamphetamine? And Mr. Bearden said, yes. If you consider the list of verbs that are in the statute, it's virtually impossible to imagine any sort of human conduct related to the use of the lithium that wouldn't fit, for example, within prepare or process, to put it in a state of readiness to use in this procedure. Thank you.
May it please the court. By the state's definition, the largest distributor of illegal methamphetamine in the state of Missouri would almost certainly be Walgreens pharmacies. That is because, as cited in my amended motion on page 7 and 6, L-methamphetamine is the active ingredient in Vicks vapor inhalers. Despite the state's characterization, although I do describe dextromethamphetamine, enantiomer of D-methamphetamine as a strong central nervous stimulant, I describe L-methamphetamine as what it is, a mild vasoconstrictor with a decongestant effect.
But thus, does the statute draw the distinction you're drawing? Does it?
Specifically, when we look at the definition of methamphetamine under the statute, it prohibits all salts, isomers, enantiomers, and other forms that have a central nervous system stimulant effect, which is, I presume, why the Attorney General's office has yet to condemn Walgreens for its meth dealing. I was tempted to stop in Walgreens and procure some methamphetamine to bring with me to court. However, I have been urged not to perform any B felonies in front of the Supreme Court or the Attorney General's office while this is under dispute. This isn't a sufficient factual basis. This is a statute that sought to condemn certain things while possibly not quite understanding the chemistry involved. The same goes for the statute on precursor chemicals. Reagents are articles that react.
Could the court infer from what he admitted to a sufficient factual basis? If you look at what he admitted to, what he said he was trying to do, I mean, do you think he was trying, do you think his admissions create an inference that he was trying to create the type of amphetamine that can't be purchased at Walgreens?
Possibly to the factual basis claim, Your Honor, but not to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Had counsel recognized this potential defense, counsel would have been on notice to hire a chemist or at least request the lab report, which usually would include an anti-antirumor test, an anti-antirumor test. However, in Missouri, it's not always included. Had counsel done what they should have done, counsel would have been able to investigate this defense. Thus, the allegation not only a factual basis, but also of ineffective assistance of counsel, both for the lithium and for our friend L-methamphetamine, the active ingredient in Vicks vapor inhalers.
Are there any cases in the state that have made this distinction?
No, it's been examined federally, including in United States versus Acklin, which dealt with the two different forms of methamphetamine. Now, the federal government has a different statute when dealing with manufacturing, and they have a lesser punishment for attempting to make L-methamphetamine without a license, but they do actively differentiate between the two and discuss the difference between the two. Missouri's statute being different when it comes to possession doesn't deal with a separate definition of methamphetamine for manufacture and only deals with the definition of methamphetamine for possession, which requires that central nervous system stimulant effect.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.